on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome to Consuming Issues. I'm Georgie Frost. Now, this is the time of the week where we welcome the team from This Is Money. That's the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Editor Simon Lambert is here today with me, with journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss for our weekly catch-up. So let's move on to our first story, shall we? We have spoken about how to act your age, but let's talk about price cutting of our energy companies. This week, EDF became the last of the big six to announce that it was cutting prices. It comes after Npower, Scottish Power, British Gas and E.ON all announced their cuts. EDF announced the lowest, though, 1.3%, and then along came the smaller energy company OVO, who'll cut their prices by a whopping 10.4%. That's more than double the largest cut by any of the big six. It also comes, though, as information from the regulator Ofgem suggests the big six companies could still be increasing profits despite cutting bills and could make £114 per household over the next year. That's up £9 from a November forecast. The papers today not very happy about it, talking about raking in bigger profits as the country freezes. Well, earlier I spoke to James Padmore, head of energy at comparethemarket.com, to get his reaction to the price cuts.
It's really interesting times at the moment. The announcements have come late and not great, with an average cut of about 4%. And obviously with the Ofgem announcement that's been put out, suppliers are just working to maintain their profits. But it's not all doom and gloom for consumers. 60% of our customers are actually switching to more competitive tariffs through smaller suppliers, and we expect that trend to continue.
Rachel, I'll turn to you first, if that's all right, as this article's literally got your name written all over it. Now, that's a bill cut. Energy Minnow OVO slashes gas prices 10.4%. Just remind us what these reductions are and why they're coming in.
They're coming in because the wholesale gas price has fallen over the past year by about 28%. Energy suppliers have been passing on some of that cut to their customers. The question is whether that goes far enough. Department for Energy and Climate Change says no, consumer groups say no as well. But perhaps the most striking indication that they don't is this 10.4% cut from OVO, which just makes you think, if they can do it, why isn't anyone else? And it makes EDF's 1.3% cut just looks so pitiful. It equates to about £9 over a year for the average household.
They were the last, weren't they, as well?
They were the last.
And they came in with this 1.3. Do you think OVO were waiting until that announcement from the final of the big six to then announce that they were going to drop it by 10.4%? Just give us some context of the other falls as well. And this doesn't actually apply to everyone, does it?
So the falls apply only to those on variable tariffs. If you've fixed, then tough luck. That's what you're signed in for the remainder of your term. And the cuts only apply to the gas part of your bill, which for most people actually is the majority of their bill anyway. It'll end up being between £9 and sort of £50 per household. All have indicated that if they can, they will pass on further cuts in future. And perhaps we'll see another round potentially after the election.
Wholesale gas prices down 28% in the past year alone, while energy bills on average only cut by 4%. Of course, the energy suppliers responded by saying that the greater cuts aren't possible because wholesale prices only make up half of your average bill.
That's it. I mean, the two justifications they give is that one, and they also say that they buy gas ahead on the markets. If this is the case, then perhaps while there might be a time lag, you would hope that in due course we'd see a much more significant cut in household bills as well.
And also, Simon, we spoke about this last week as well. It's important to note, looking at when some of these cuts come in, SSE jumps to mind, 4.1% cut coming in 30th of April.
Yes, something I referred to as sneaky, I think, last week. I mean, it's worth pointing out that this OVO cut doesn't come in until March, but then OVO's already cut once winter,
yeah.
And so it's already lowered its prices.
This is the 11th cut by OVO in the past 18 months.
I actually switched energy suppliers before Christmas to OVO, mainly because I wanted to go with a small supplier. I'd actually said I was going to do it a year earlier, and then customer inertia, that great thing, got hold of me and I didn't do anything about it. But I moved from Npower to OVO and I went for one of their fixed tariffs, and so I won't actually benefit from this cut. OVO have said, I asked Rachel to look into this, and OVO, I think, said that people could switch between their tariffs, but you'd have to pay a £30 exit fee per fuel. So I'd have to weigh up whether that was worth doing. I don't think it is. But the reason why I liked OVO and the reason why I like some of the other small energy companies is they've basically run rings around the big six. Effectively, there's been competition, but no real competition. One puts up prices, they all put up prices, and it all moves in sync with each other. This argument of, well, wholesale prices only make up a small amount of your bill, that is true. And a lot of your bill comes from the cost of distributing and all the other things that come on top of it. You know, the price of a bowl of spaghetti in a restaurant doesn't just reflect the price of buying that. But the argument they use when lowering prices is very different to the argument they use when raising prices. The criticism that has been levied at energy companies over the last 5 years is that they've been very quick to raise prices and very slow to lower prices. And despite the fact that they've all lowered prices this year, I still think they've been too slow, and I still think that criticism sticks.
And now, of course, papers reporting today that they could still make a profit for us, describing the energy giants as greedy and reporting that their profits could soar up 1,000%.
They are private companies. They are there to make a profit for their shareholders, and that is the way that we have organised our energy market. It's unfortunate that a lot of those companies, in fact, actually, they're not even all there to make profits for their shareholders. Some of them are actually, I mean, EDF is Electricité de France. But what you have to remember is that whilst, yes, they have to make a profit, it's this element of growing the profits that people aren't happy about, especially when you look at cuts coming in that are delayed for a couple of months, cuts coming in that we think are too little. It all adds into that feeling that we're being done over slightly here. The big six do argue that the small companies don't incur the same costs. And there is potentially this thing where when some of these smaller energy suppliers, if they ever get above a certain size, they will start incurring extra costs that ultimately they will have to pass on to the customers. So it will be very interesting to see how this whole thing turns out over the next couple of years.
So it's only profitable at the moment for us while it remains below a certain number of people joining. So if we all switch at once, is this going to work?
OVO's passed the threshold, actually, as has First Utility, and they're still managing it. 2 million, I think, people have now switched to the small suppliers.
Figures from Energy UK, you say, reveal that 1.3 million customers moved from a large supplier to a small one during the last 12 months alone, the equivalent of 41% of all switches.
The thing is that the small suppliers are competing on price, so they're often at the top of the Best Buy tables. Most people who switch through price comparison sites. And when you go on one of those and you see that the top five deals available are from small suppliers, it makes you think. I think also there was a wariness until now about who are these companies. I don't know that name. Will they go bust? What will happen if I switch? Can I trust them? But as they grow in size, those reservations start to fall away.
And Simon, from a personal experience, was it worth switching and was it easy?
Yeah, it was dead easy. I mean, we've got an energy bills comparison on This Is Money. You go to thisismoney.co.uk/fuel bills, put in your postcode, and all you've got to do is basically look up your usage on your old bills. It takes 5 minutes, if that. And as Rachel says, those small companies came out top of the pile. And you'll get some of the big companies and some of their tariffs in there as well. But my personal view is that if you want to try and get change in an industry, then sometimes, even if the big one does come out cheaper, maybe you should choose the smaller, slightly more expensive one, because that's putting the pressure on the big companies. So maybe it's not all about price, it's about intention as well. But in this instance, you're quite lucky, because not only can you support the small suppliers, but they're actually cheaper.
That voice you're hearing is editor Simon Lambert from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website Money section of The Mail Online, in the studio with journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.
I'm Georgie Frost, and you're listening to Consuming Issues here on Share Radio with you every weekday from 9 until 1 with my producer Annie Weston on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. Now, Greece has a new anti-austerity coalition government in place. The election earlier this week saw over 36% of Greeks vote for radical left-wingers Syriza, who vowed to renegotiate the country's £179 billion international bailout deal and increase spending. Well, they've joined forces with the right-of-centre party, the Independent Greeks. Syriza supporters celebrated the election in Athens, when the Prime Minister David Cameron warned will increase economic uncertainty across Europe.
Let's hope that this will be a message to build the Europe of solidarity.
Austerity is a European problem, and solving at the European base is the only realistic solution.
Syriza took 149 seats. That was too short of an absolute majority, so they joined forces with the right of centre party, the Independent Greeks, also anti-austerity. I got a reaction from Share Radio's Morning Money business producer, Michael Kosmidis, himself a proud Athenian.
It's quite celebratory, I think. Greeks, you know, they are not under any kind of illusion that things are going to be easy. I think very many people have reached very much to the point where, even if it gets worse, it cannot get much worse than already is with the situation as it is. They are tired and angry with the political system, with the two main parties that have controlled the lack of Greece since 1974, continuously between them. That was expressed with that vote. They know it's going to be difficult. It's a resounding no to all the austerity policies. It's one of the rare, I would say, and judging also from French messages and all that, days of happiness, really, for people in the streets. But as I said, they all know that, okay, in a day or two when things start getting serious, a government is formed, and then things will be difficult. And many also people would like to see at least some of those things that were promised beforehand by Syriza to be implemented. And that may prove difficult.
Politicians, lots of promises being made.
Lots of promises. Of course, politicians being politicians, sometimes they are careful on that. So, for example, it was said that those who were fired, laid off from the public sector in a way that was not proper, they will be restituted and get back to job. The way it is phrased, as you realize, I mean, who is properly laid off and who is not properly laid off? Lots of questions and discussions can be there. Plus, I think that Syriza right now has also, the fact that he is in a coalition government gives him the opportunity to say that, you know, I cannot implement my program because it's not 100% my government, it's 90 or 99% or whatever that is. Have to backtrack on some of the issues and then we'll see.
That was Share Radio's Morning Money business producer, Michael Kosmidis, who is from Athens himself. So lots of promises made by Alexis Tsipras there in the run-up to the election. But can he deliver? And what happens next to the debt? Well, the Prime Minister is meeting the current head of the Eurozone group of finance ministers shortly to discuss the conditions of Greece's massive bailout. It all raises the question of whether some of those debts should be forgiven. Firmly on the table, yet perhaps it would be simply better off to get them out of the euro altogether. Perhaps seeing a smaller and tighter currency union formed. Simon Lambert, I'll bring you in. It all comes as well in the wake of that huge quantitative easing programme by the ECB, and now the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, in a speech this week accused the Eurozone of being timid in the reforms needed to drag it out of stagnation. Lots to talk about here, Simon. Firstly, where are we at with the Greece situation? How did they get into this situation?
Greece got into this situation due to the formation of the Eurozone and the arrival of the Euro. It had to fulfil certain criteria to get in. They were fudged. They were fudged for many countries, actually. And then through the good years in the early 2000s, Greece spent more money than it should have done, lived above its means, as did many countries. When the financial crisis arrived, all of that came home to roost. Greece has ended up with huge debts. And what's happened since then, really, since the financial crisis, since 2010 particularly, is Greece has essentially just been lent vast sums of money by the Eurozone and the IMF in this attempt to keep it afloat. And most of that money, I think there's a misconception that I picked up
gone?
On something I wrote. People think a lot of that money's gone on basically supporting the Greeks, supporting the running of the Greek economy. But actually, the vast majority of it has gone on basically preventing Greece defaulting on that debt. So essentially on protecting those who lent it money. Now, Greece's debts are basically unsustainable, unpayable, in fact. And there's this game of extend and pretend that's going on, where they're just lengthening out the loans, lowering down the interest rates. And realistically, it's got such large debts that you can't see any way out of this. Greece is arguing that it should have some form of write-down on those debts to bring them down to a sustainable level. This is what Syriza are arguing. They've said they want to renegotiate the debt, but they've said that they want to stay within the Eurozone. My personal view is that Greece should have some of that debt written down. I think that borrowers are responsible, but lenders are responsible too. If you draw an analogy, which is always dangerous with country debt, but if you draw an analogy with personal debt, if you borrow too much money and you actually cannot pay it back, you have a couple of options open. You can go for something called an IVA, a voluntary agreement with your creditors, where you negotiate the debts down and you work out what you can pay. Or you can go bankrupt. And there are consequences of going bankrupt, but essentially you eventually get back on your feet. And the same with defaulting on your debts. You know, there are consequences of defaulting. There are consequences of writing them down, but it helps you get back on your feet. The people who've lent Greece the money, and the fact that a lot of this money has gone to just keeping Greece in the Eurozone because the Eurozone leaders don't want the Eurozone to split up, I think Greece deserves some sympathy. And I think that the current situation of austerity and the debts are basically pushing a country into major crisis. The Eurozone needs to recognise that and do something about it. But actually, personally, I think Greece would be better off out of the Eurozone. I don't think the Eurozone's done Greece any favours. I don't think it's done a lot of countries any favours. I think it was a bad idea in the first place. I think it's caused more problems over the last 15 years than it's solved. More division, more recriminations, more arguments. And I think sometimes you just have to put your hands up and say, this didn't work. We had an idea. It didn't work. We need to change it. And I think that change needs to come. And if allowing Greece to leave the Eurozone involves some other countries saying, well, we want out too, then the Eurozone would need to take a good long look at why they want out, because it's just not working.
Talk about the money there, and it's interesting when you look at where it has gone. And they've had all of this money, 260 billion euros of money, and yet unemployment in the country, just to give some context, is 26%. Youth unemployment above 50%. GDP and spending have dived, with the latter down at least 40%. You do quote in your very good article, actually, should Greece be forgiven some of its debts or should it just leave the Eurozone? Martin Wolf, who outlined the case as to why it's a mistake for Greece to leave in the FT. He says creating the Eurozone is the second worst monetary idea its members are ever likely to have. Breaking it up is worse.
Yeah, and that's actually the point where I disagree with what he said in his FT article, because I actually think that if the Eurozone wants to continue as a currency union, then a smaller, tighter currency union of countries that are more similar rather than these disparate nations. You know, look, the UK is doing a lot better than the rest of Europe at the moment because we have control over our own monetary policy. We could print money, we allowed our currency to devalue, and we brought down the yields on our bonds, and we dealt with our problem that way.
Which is something now, Italy used to do as well.
Yeah, which is something, you know, Italy would do this in the past as well. Italy's got this massive debt mountain that it's trying to deal with. But the interesting thing about both Greece and Italy, actually, and this is the thing about Greece, that Martin Wolfer picked up on something that was written by a Greek blogger who writes for a blog called Macropolis that had crunched down these numbers. Since 2013, Greece has run a primary surplus, which means that basically it spends less than it gets in before you allow for the debt repayments. So Greece actually has imposed quite strong austerity and actually is balancing its books. It's only the interest on that debt that means it's not balancing the books.
But it has to, and that was part of
the
deal.
Yeah, that's what it has to do. But it's taken those tough choices and it has done it. And only 11% of the total funding from all of that bailout money and loans has actually gone on supporting the Greek state. The rest of it's mainly gone on interest payments, maturing debt, and helping the financial system. I don't think that this is a sustainable path to go down, and I think they need to change tack. I think maybe they should have a referendum that says, well, actually, should we do that, or should we just leave?
What is the significance? You mentioned there, Syriza. What is the significance of this election outcome? And let's bear in mind as well that they made big promises ahead of this, not just to renegotiate the debt, but also to welfare spending. So more spending.
Yeah. And
is it possible?
I don't think so, to be honest. Greece is undergoing immense austerity. The situation in Greece is really bad. Whether they can start raising spending again, I'm not sure whether that is a good idea. But what I think this is a massive protest vote. This is the Greek people saying, no, enough. We're not happy with this. We can't continue down this route. And you're going to see more of that. We saw a massive protest vote in Italy last time around when they had elections with the Beppe Grillo's like five-star party. That got a lot of the vote. There's a party, an anti-austerity party in Spain as well, that's seeing a large amount of support. And I just think it's a mistake not to look at this and say, do you know what, this isn't working, we need to do something different.
It's worth bearing in mind, though, that if Greece doesn't pay back some of this debt, there are countries like Italy, like Spain, that have lent money that will be also out of pocket as well.
That's very true, but it's worth remembering this thing where people say, well, if we just let Greece renegotiate some of its debts, or Greece default, then everybody else will want to do that. Now, Greece's borrowing costs have risen above 10% this week, whereas the other country's borrowing costs are around sort of 3%. But just because one person goes bankrupt or one person says that they can't afford to pay their debts doesn't mean that everybody else does it. You know, if those people can continue to repay your debts, then you will do that because you don't want the consequences. And those countries know that if they do try and renegotiate their debts, or they did try and default or do something like that, there would be consequences. So it's not like saying just because you allow Greece to do it, there'll suddenly be this queue of people trying to do it. But maybe we should be looking at Italy's debts, Spain's debts, and saying, where are we here? And do we need to be thinking about doing something a bit different to this? Because, you know, just before the elections in Greece, the ECB introduced quantitative easing.
Exactly.
And essentially the idea behind that is print some money, throw it at a wall, hope it sticks.
Figures out at the moment, deflation across the 19 Eurozone countries, gathering pace in January. Prices in the Eurozone were 0.6% down on their levels a year ago, showing the Eurozone heading deeper into deflationary territory.
The thing about deflation is that we've got the oil price falling, we've got energy prices falling. This is all bringing down the cost of living. And so some of that deflation is not all bad. It's good deflation. But some of it is the byproduct of austerity. If you can't devalue your currency like Greece has, then you've got to bring in swinging cuts on jobs, on wages, on spending. And that by its very nature is deflationary.
Well, there are two bits of good news. Unemployment, which fell to 11.4% in December. That's down from 11.5%. And also some other Eurozone good news. Bright spot for German breweries, who saw their first increase in sales volumes in 2014 after 7 years of decline.
Sharing ideas about money on London Digital and online. This is Share Radio.
I'm Georgie Frost, a very warm welcome to Consuming Issues here every weekday from 9 until 1 with my producer Annie Weston on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. I'm joined in the studio by the team from This Is Money, the award-winning financial website and money section of the Mail Online. Editor Simon Lambert is today joined by journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss. We were talking there about the troubles in the Eurozone and Greece. Now let's turn our attention to home building, which appears to be rising across the UK. The National House Building Council says more than 145,000 properties were registered last year. That's a 9% rise on 2013. It comes as the annual house price growth slowed for a fifth month in a row in January, according to the Nationwide. House prices rose 6.8% during the month compared with the year before. That's down from 7.2% in December. So are we about to enter a buyer's market now? I spoke to Richard Gardner, chief economist at Nationwide, about their figures.
The housing market is continuing to slow. We've seen activity in the housing market slow quite dramatically over the last 4 or 5 months. We've seen the number of mortgages approval, for example, down 20% compared to the beginning of 2014. And what we're seeing is price growth easing as a result. House price growth peaked at about 12% over the summer, and it's now slowed to 6.8%.
It's worth noting it's still growing.
Yes, and 6.8% is still a healthy pace of growth. It's certainly far quicker than income growth. Incomes are rising about 2% a year at the moment, so clearly quite a big gap there. I suppose what that suggests is, even though we've had a big decline in mortgage demand, as I said, mortgage approvals down really quite significantly over the last few months, price growth only gently moderating. That probably means that the supply of property coming onto the market is also slowing to a trickle. Unemployment has been falling really quite sharply in the second half of 2014, and that's clearly, it helps to explain why consumers are feeling so much more optimistic than they did, say, 12, 18 months ago. We've seen wage growth picking up. It's still very weak by historic standards, but at least now it's rising faster than the cost of living. Consumer sentiment seems to be very strong, and yet, so it's a little bit puzzling why mortgage demand has been weakening in the last 4 or 5 months. What we've seen is hardly any new properties coming onto the market. The rate of new homes being built, that has picked up a little bit from the very low levels we had during the financial crisis, but they're still way below where they were, say, in 2007. So at the moment, if you look at the number of houses built in England, it's about 30% or so below the level in 2007. And even in 2007, we weren't building enough homes to keep up with a natural increase in the population. So the lack of supply of new housing helps to explain why house price growth has remained fairly robust.
So that was Richard Gardner, chief economist at Nationwide, speaking there. Simon Lambert, editor of This Is Money. You heard there about lack of house building and new properties coming onto the market is thought to be behind that robust growth in house prices, although he has says it's slowed. First, before we start, I do have to check a few things. This is how forensically I go through the articles on This Is Money. They are very good. There's two articles that I've read recently, written 2 days apart from each other, showing very different prices in the average price of a home. Explain why one is set at 271,000 and one is 177,000.
Well, that's because when economists compile house price surveys, they stand there and throw darts at a wall. No, look, due to the different data they use, many of our readers actually probably do think that these house price figures involve throwing darts. And you could be forgiven for thinking so.
If you live in London.
I think estate agents throw darts at a wall to decide how high to price houses in London. The Nationwide uses its own mortgage data and then works that back to deliver its average house price. So that is dependent upon just those people who are taking out mortgages with Nationwide to buy. The Office of National Statistics uses something called the Regulated Mortgage Survey, which is conducted by the Council of Mortgage Lenders. So that includes data from all the mortgage lenders. But then I also think that the ONS also uses an element of land registry prices as well. I'm not entirely certain. Now, the land registry actually produces two sets of house price data. The land registry monthly house price data, which is based on something called the... it's a repeat sales formula. So it's only houses that have sold more than once over the past certain period of time. I think it goes back to sort of about the mid-90s. And so that actually excludes, and it also excludes new build property. So if you buy a brand new property, that's not included. So that takes out the equation houses that have been owned for a long time and are then sold, and also any brand new properties. It puts the average house price at about 180, I think. The Land Registry all transactions data, which includes every single transaction.
Kind of wishing I never asked this now.
That puts the average house price nearer to the ONS one, about 270. So even the Land Registry has a £100,000 gap between its two sets of data.
You really do know everything.
What you need to do is basically there is no average house. The average house does not exist. What you need to do more is look at the trends in how the numbers move. And that's what's important. The trends are very similar. So the trends tend to be within a couple of percentage points of each other.
Excellent. And what are the trends showing us at the moment and why are they?
The trends are showing us that house price growth, overall headline house price growth, is slowing. And that's because the heat is coming out of the London market.
So reason?
Because prices simply got too expensive to the point where people couldn't pay for them. And we also had the introduction of new mortgage rules last year that meant lenders were checking up a lot more on affordability. There are areas in London, normal person areas in London, where prices are up £100,000 in a year, or were at one point last summer. That's completely unsustainable. We can't continue to have that happen. And just one point about these Nationwide figures is largely house price growth is driven by cheap credit. It's to do with mortgage rates. Mortgage rates are on the floor at the moment. That 2% rise in the average wage, if the £26,000 average wage would be £520 over the last year, the 6% rise in the average house price would be £10,000. So a situation where wages are going up by £500 and houses are going up by £10,000 is not sustainable.
May explain it as well. But also he was saying there when I spoke to Richard Gardner at Nationwide, it was all about building new houses. So in 2007, of course, Labour government set this target for 240,000 homes. Apparently, for decades after World War II, we used to build more than 300,000 homes every year. And we are facing a bit of a house building crisis because we're nowhere near that, really.
No, we're nowhere near that. It obviously hit a bottom after the financial crisis and there was a major slump, but it's picked up quite a lot since then. My personal view is I don't buy the shortage of houses driving house prices argument, because I believe that it's to do with mortgage credit. We don't build enough houses in this country, but I'm not certain that if we suddenly massively raised the amount of house building, it would really affect it. And I would point to places like Spain or the US or Ireland, where they all managed to have massive house price booms whilst also building a lot of houses.
This secret diary of a first-time buyer, though, it says, I'm about to spend £360,000 on a dinky, cracked window terrace shoebox with no central heating, but the agent says it's a bargain. And I love the fact that it's written here, all this estate agent speaking a whole new language, jargon, blank canvas equals uninhabitable tip, great investment, 1/2 bedrooms. We've had it all before, haven't we?
Our secret buyer is in London. Yeah. And we've had a lot of comments from people saying, well, just don't buy in London then. But actually, this is true of people buying all over the country. It might not be that those property markets are as red hot as the London one has been, but first-time buyers in any major town or city or any place around the country suffer exactly the same problems and feel exactly the same things and feel that the game is very much loaded against them. And you do have to be wary about these things. And whether you're in London or Liverpool or Manchester or Newcastle,
yeah,
you need to watch out. Be, you know, really pick up on what the estate agent's saying. Really drill into those properties and think about the fact of, would I be happy living here for the next 5 years? Because, you know, you might think, oh, well, I'll move in a couple of years and so I could get somewhere a bit smaller than I need or things like that. But things change. You know, you might not be able to move. You might be stopped from moving. Prices might fall, interest rates might go up. So make sure that you'd be happy somewhere for at least 5 years. And the best tip that I could give to people is look for something that you could improve and add some value to. Because if you buy something that's absolutely top spec, walk straight into, don't worry about anything, you'll always be reliant upon what happens to the market for how its price moves. Whereas if you've got something that you can in some way improve, even if it's just doing it up a bit, but especially if it's like adding a bedroom or something like that, converting the loft, then you've got that extra little bit where you can try and gain something.
So there's something to be said about estate agents as talking about great investment and 1/2 bedrooms, for example.
1/2 bedrooms. I live in London. We when we moved 4 years ago, I must have spent a year looking at flats. It took so long for us to find a flat that we sold our flat to some people who actually turned out to be buying it as an investment and rented it back off them while we were still looking.
No.
Yeah, but some of the things that get called a bedroom, you know, they were quite literally cupboards. And yes, everybody knows that estate agent speak is true. But, you know, there is a tip also, make the estate agent your friend. If you can find a good one, make them your friend, because they'll tell you about stuff if they think you're a serious buyer, and you'll get a foot in the door before other people.
Also, Simon, I'm starting to wonder, looking around London, if there is a sort of dump premium. Lots of people recognise that in such an expensive market, you need to find somewhere that you can add value. And in a sense, I'm finding that that is already priced into properties. We saw one. It's on Zoopla, and it's described as a 3-bed detached house. And then if you look at the floor plan, there's nothing. They're selling a hole in between two other houses and describing it as a 3-bed terrace.
As in there's literally nothing
there.
It's a building plot.
It is a building plot that they're describing as a 3-bed.
Which Rachel sent over to me, and we had a conversation about this. And the building plot is great. It is a building plot. But the building plot's being advertised for something like £320,000. Now, you can actually look up, and it's planning permission for a house that's exactly identical to the other houses on the road. You can look up those streets and see how much those identical houses are for sale for. And there's houses on the market identical for £550. Now, if you buy that building plot for £320, to fully build that house and fit it out, probably going to cost you about £200,000. Allow a margin for costs going up of 10%, and all of a sudden you've hit £550, and you haven't made any profit. Now, the idea behind doing up property is that you always want about a 20% profit for your work, because you are taking the entrepreneurial risk. And as Rachel says, there is this dump premium, and estate agents basically go, well, if you did that work, it would cost you that much, so therefore it would be worth this much. And then they're forgetting to add in the reward for you taking the risk and doing the work.
And also, bearing in mind, you'll have nowhere to live while you're building up, so you're going to have to pay somewhere to rent or keep hold of your old house. That voice you're hearing is editor Simon Lambert and journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
Let's turn our attention to Sky. It's launching a mobile phone service, agreed a partnership with O2 operator Telefonica that will give the media firm wholesale access to 2, 3 and 4G services on its nationwide network. It takes Sky into the battle for quad play, adding mobile to its existing services of internet, landline and TV. Offering all four services is seen as the next big UK growth area for the telecoms firms and broadcasters. With such bundled services already pretty popular in much of mainland Europe, the deal comes as rival BT looks to spend £12.5 billion to buy current mobile market leader EE. Rachel, you've been looking at this. What's the significance of this?
Potentially, it can only be good news for consumers. There does seem to be this movement towards bundled packages whereby you get your TV, your telephone, your broadband and your mobile from the same provider. And as such, you end up paying a little bit less if you get them all at one go, particularly for families if you get all of your mobile deals together. This is something that all of the big providers are looking towards. So they're all sort of trying to fill in the final pieces of their jigsaw puzzle. Maybe they've got three of the services and they're looking for their fourth. And that's what this deal is about with Sky, and also what BT is looking to do with EE. TalkTalk does it, I think, as well to a lesser extent, and Virgin Media. The more parties that we have in this field, the better for competition, the better prices we end up with for consumers.
Is it better for competition, though, with Sky becoming so big?
Well, there is a concern, I think, with the BTEE thing. We're seeing less players, but now Sky stepped in to deliver an extra player. But Sky, you have to really compare against Virgin, don't you? Because that's their big contender, or perhaps TalkTalk. And I don't know, it's very difficult. And I've heard talk that... So there always used to be this classic move that basically if you were an existing Sky customer or a Virgin customer, you call them up, basically tell them you're going to leave, going to go to the other one and start negotiating on prices. But we were having a conversation about this the other day and there was a little bit of talk about maybe they're playing hardball a bit more on some of this, and people are ringing up and doing that and saying, oh, I want to go. And Ed, who couldn't be here today, he's played hardball with Sky before, mm-hmm. and he's not convinced that he won. He thinks that Sky definitely won, and he described them as evil geniuses.
One problem, of course, with this sort of bundled scenario is it's very harder to price compare. I'm finding that I've been looking a lot this week into call charges for landlines. They're all over the place. And I think it's just the case that you're not comparing like for like necessarily. You might be getting a better deal perhaps on your landline, but then are you getting the best deal on your broadband? It's very hard to sort of...
So how can you check? Is there a way?
It's tricky. I suppose keep an eye on what's the services that are a priority to you. And make sure that you're getting the best deal possible on those. Make sure that you're... You know, the thing is, they add all these bundles and add-ons, and you can buy different TV channels, and you can have higher speeds, and then you add bundles for international calling rates. And then by the time you've added them all up, mm-hmm. then you're running into, you know, twice the price that you thought you were going to pay in the first place. It's not just a matter of comparing the headline figures, especially they often lock you in for 24 months, these companies, before you sign up. Once you've heard the hard sell, just make sure that if you're being offered, you know, the best deals on the best speed possible, is that really what's important to you, or would you rather have cheap phone calls?
How do you know? What difference does best speed make? I mean, for somebody who's not particularly bothered by this sort of thing.
Well, there is this problem, of course, where advertised broadband speeds appear to be almost entirely fictional. The up to 100
yeah, exactly.
megabytes. I mean, I believe that I may possibly have up to 100 megabyte broadband with Virgin. And I think I get about 8 or 10.
Oh, wow.
Ultimately, if you're going to be regularly streaming stuff, so watching video on your computer or on your television now, a lot of people are doing, you need to have a decent speed. If you're just going to be using it for surfing the internet, sending some emails, so you don't need to worry too much about it. Or if you're going to be the kind of person who downloads a lot of music. And actually, I think, you know, like Rachel's saying, what you need to do is you need to sit down and think, well, how do I use this? What's the bit that's important to me? What's the bit that I want? You know, do I need all these bundles and packages and things that I'm being shoved into? Because that's where they cream a lot of money off on the top, is like poking you into these packages. Or actually, sometimes you might be better off in one, because Rachel was looking into international calling charges with BT this week, and her exact words to me were, she came over and I think you basically said, this just doesn't make any sense.
What was that about, Rachel? What doesn't make any sense?
Well, so what I've been looking into this week, actually, is it costs, Well, it will cost from, I think, the 25th of February, twice as much to phone France or Spain on a BT landline than phoning Brazil or Russia. I've been asking anyone I can for an explanation, and it's true that the prices that we pay for our phone calls can vary according to the wholesale prices that that operators pay. However, if that's the case, you would expect them sort of to move the operator cost to move broadly in line. And why it can be that every other supplier charges more to phone Brazil and Russia than France and Spain, and BT is the reverse. Confusing is the generous way of putting it.
The answer that we came up with was that you were basically far more likely to phone France or Spain, so BT was just profiteering on it.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost on Share Radio.
And now for our final story of the day, where we're going to be talking about baby groomers, because there's been a surge in over 50s swapping the open seas for the open road and becoming bikers. So much so, in fact, in a sign of the growing interest in motorcycling, Saga, the company specialising in services and cruises for the over 50s, has splashed out a cool $26.6 million to buy Bennett's. They're a specialist motorbike insurer renowned in biker circles. So Saga, most famous then for its cruise holidays, said it made the move after recognising a spike in the take-up of motorbiking among its target audience. As a result, we've been asking you today what you do to not act your age. We did talk about liking Disney movies, but I'll give you a chance to actually tell us what your real answer was, editor Simon Lambert and journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss. What do you do where you seriously don't act your age?
I skateboard.
Do you?
Yes, I do.
God, do they still do that?
Yeah, it's one of my hobbies. I skateboard in a bowl, you know, on a ramp.
Oh, wow.
Not on the streets. I've never been any good at street skating, but I skateboard. I fractured my wrist last summer, actually. There are kids there, but there are also people there who are my age or in their 20s. There's a lot of people there who are older than me. When I fractured my wrist, there were four people in the skateboard park, and not a single one of us were under 30. And they're not, like, my friends kind of thing. They're just people I bump into down there and meet down there. So, you know, it's a sport. It's good. I didn't skate for about 6 years in my 20s, and one of my big regrets is doing that. Should have kept skating the whole way through.
Shouldn't have. You might not have fractured.
That's just a hazard of the sport.
Unfortunate. Rachel, yourself?
Roly polies.
I want to have photographic evidence of both of these things. Did she do that in the office, Simon?
We don't have enough room. The thing is, I've done it since I was very little. I see an empty corridor, and I can't really help it. It's got nice carpet. It's perfect.
So she comes back in with her hair all over the place and a little bit rouge in the face. So we're talking about Saga here. Tell us about this story. What have you found?
I mean, they've bought up this motorcycle insurer, but this is a trend across the board, really, of people in their over 50s or the early retirement, what would be termed the baby boom generation, continuing to do things that they enjoy. You know, it's a classic cliche, but people are younger at an older age nowadays. There's people who retire in, you know, their early 60s or mid 60s, and they still want to get out there and do things. They want to go skiing. They want to ride a motorbike. They want to do all these things, and they have the added advantage over much of the rest of the population, in that they've got the money to spend on doing it, because
exactly.
Many of them have worked hard their whole life to enjoy their retirement. So why not enjoy your retirement? Just be careful on your motorbike there, Dad.
And it's also the way that they're using it slightly differently. So not for commuting, for going out and enjoying.
Yeah, well, it's like classic cars, isn't it? There's been this big classic car boom. A lot of that is also to do with people just buying the cars that they loved when they were younger. It's, you know, it's not necessarily the Ferraris and the Porsches and things like that. You know, if you want to buy a mint condition 1970s Ford Escort, it could cost you £20,000.
You ever been on a motorbike, Simon?
I've been on a scooter on holiday. I haven't ridden a proper motorbike, and I don't have a motorbike licence, mainly because of the fear that if I did get one, I would really, really like it and be a serious danger to myself.
Simon Lava, editor of This Is Money and journalist Rachel Rickard-Strauss, thank you very much for joining us.
On digital radio and online, this is Share Radio.